Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. As you've been hearing on WYPR and NPR, Judge Barry Williams has issued his verdict in the case of Officer Cesar Goodson, the driver of the van in which Freddie Gray was fatally injured. Goodson was found not guilty on all six counts, including second-degree depraved heart murder and manslaughter. Later in the hour, we'll discuss an unusual film festival coming to Baltimore. It's called Cinema Ephemera, the Festival of Useful Film. The lineup includes film trailers, home movies, educational films, and footage from promotional tourism videos. What is useful film, and what can we learn from the forgotten fringes of film history? We'll talk with two aficionados, but first, WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns is here with me in the studio. Welcome back, Kenny.
Thank you.
And defense attorney Warren Brown, who has been following the police trials in the Freddie Gray case. Thanks for joining
us.
No
problem.
So, Kenny Burns, you were in court this morning. What should we know about the main points of Judge Barry's verdict? Judge Barry Williams' verdict? What did he conclude?
Well, the main thing, as far as a takeaway for me, he kept saying no evidence presented that Goodson knew or should have known, quote unquote, the acute medical distress Gray was in. The injury that Freddie Gray suffered, and he pointed this out, it's not as if it was physically obvious. It's not as if you came across a car wreck, as I told Tom Hall this morning, and you saw either a broken limb or a laceration. This injury happened internally. And the judge said, as far as any average officer in Goodson's position, they would have known if he was really under medical distress or not.
So Judge Williams is basically saying you cannot hold Officer Goodson to a standard, any of the crimes that would involve intent, because
right.
You can't assume from what was presented in court that the driver knew there was a serious injury.
Exactly right.
And what did Judge Williams say in particular, or did he say anything about the rough ride theory, the theory that the prosecution laid out early in its case? I'm not sure. I had the impression it didn't really come up again much in the closing arguments, the theory that Goodson had deliberately driven in a rough manner to injure the person in the back of his van.
It came up towards the end. In fact, he called rough ride in his verdict an inflammatory term. And that only one witness, Sanford or Neil Franklin, he was a state witness, actually defined it. But either way, you had two state witnesses who said they did not see any characteristics of a rough ride in what was presented, specifically the video of Fremont and Riggs, where Goodson makes a wide right. It looked like he ran a stop sign, but the judge said you can't tell if he even ran the stop sign because he could have stopped just short of the intersection, or he just didn't have enough video footage to tell what Goodson actually did in context of that right turn that the state was showing or trying to prove that was the actual rough ride. And also, he was also trying to avoid a parked van at that intersection that was close to where people normally make the turn.
Warren Brown, you have observed, I guess, probably, what, hundreds, thousands of criminal trials,
yes,
and participated in
yes,
in many.
Yes.
What struck you about Judge Williams' verdict?
Much the same as that was referenced by Kenny, that the judge pointed to an absence of evidence. And even if you think back, and Kenny may support me on this, in the closing argument of Michael Schatzow, you were given an opportunity to get a sense of where the judge was, but also you got a sense of the absence of evidence that the state had, because they had telling the judge, well, you can draw rational inferences from what we have offered. And to many, an inference is that bridge between what I've presented, the evidence I've presented, and the result that I'm seeking, the conclusion I'm trying to reach. I can't, what I presented doesn't take me all the way to the result that I want you to, that I want to achieve. So I want to utilize inferences. And so you constantly heard about, well, judge, you can draw an inference of this, or you can draw an inference of that, when the judge would speak to them about the absence of facts, of evidence to support their positions. And so what you found was, throughout the case, the judge being concerned that there was this absence of evidence that they were kind of right. I think they expected a jury trial, for one, that the state, that the defense would opt for. And they were expecting the motions of it to carry them over. But when unexpectedly the defense decided on a court trial the morning of trial, it changed the whole tenor. But the state didn't change their presentation. They were still presenting it as if it was going to be to a jury, to the extent of not shoring up their position with facts and evidence, but relying on inferences.
That is defense lawyer Warren Brown here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the verdict today in the Officer Cesar Goodson case, acquittal on all six charges against him in the death of Freddie Gray. Also with us here in the studio is WYPR reporter Kenny Brown.
Burns.
Excuse me. Sorry. I know who you
That's
are.
Right.
Ken Burns, who has been covering the trial for WYPR.
Happens more than you realize.
Well, this is turning into something of an epic, and maybe that's why I was thinking of the esteemed documentarian, because we've had now three trials, two not guilty verdicts, both by the judge, a hung jury in the first trial of Officer William Porter. The Baltimore Sun did some reporting afterwards that said that jury was close to acquittal on a manslaughter charge, but Officer Porter will be tried again.
Maybe.
So he's not off. Three more trials, counting the Porter trial, four more trials, three other officers. First off, Warren Brown, picking up on a point that you made, should we assume that the other defendants are all going to choose to have bench trials?
Yeah, probably. I think so. They have the benefit of two well-reasoned opinions from this judge, one in Officer Nero's case and the other in Officer Goodson's case. They can seize from that the judge's feelings, as can the prosecution, and they will. How that his opinion relates to the facts of their case. For example, on the issue of seat belting, I think that the prosecution and the two defense teams in these two cases, the court trial, came away understanding that just the seat belting, the failure to seat belt alone is not going to get the state over the hurdle on these charges. And so, yes, I think that there will be subsequent requests for a court trial. The question is whether or not the state will try to interrupt that by asking the judge to recuse himself if any other of the defendants ask for a court trial. But I think
walk me through that, because I don't know. If the prosecution asks the judge to recuse himself, he is the judge who rules on that.
That's
right?
Correct. And most judges consider that insulting to be asked to be recused, because what you're saying is you can't be fair. Judge, we don't think you can be fair for any number of reasons, and so therefore we're asking that you step aside. And that rubs most judges the wrong way. But I think, the state has to look at this and say, my goodness, if the rest of them ask for a court trial, we're going to lose those as well.
A bench trial.
Bench trial, same thing.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes, that we're going to lose those as well. And the defense is again, looking at what the judge has done in these two prior cases, looking at the facts. Just because he found these guys not guilty doesn't mean that he's going to find everybody else not guilty just because. But when you look at the facts of each case, you look at his reasoning, then it's easy to conclude that when I look at the facts of my case, the reasoning in these other cases where the facts are very similar, I can expect the same result. Keeping in mind now, the state has got to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, this is something I wish one of you could explain to me, and that is the prosecution took the steps it needed to take to make Officer Porter testify against his fellow officers in subsequent trials, which the Court of Appeals eventually said he would have to do, and which the other officers would have to do also. But there was a great deal made about having a completely separate prosecutorial team so that whatever those officers said in a trial that was not their own trial could not be used against them in their trial. that was
clean team, I think they refer to
the
it
clean
as.
Team or
but let me
team.
Say something about that, though. The irony of all this really is that in the judge's opinion today, he referenced Officer Porter's testimony quite a bit to undermine the state's contentions, you know, in terms of what was going on at stop number four. You know, he used Porter's testimony to undermine the state's position with regard to many of the charges. And so, you know, they went through all this.
I did not know that. So
yes,
are you telling me that basically using Officer Porter as a state's witness backfired?
Yeah, it did. But they absolutely had to use him because at least he put forth that there was he mentioned to Officer Goodson that Freddie Gray says, you know, he wants to go to a hospital, he wants a medic. They needed that, you know, just to impute knowledge on the part of Goodson. But even as Kenny was saying, the judge pointed out that the man was not in, you know, obvious physical serious distress, medical distress. So they needed him. But, you know, they got some good, but they got some bad from Porter. And the judge referenced Porter's testimony quite a bit today in rendering his decision that the state had not met their burden, especially with regard to the manslaughter and the murder charges. And so they went through all this effort to get Porter in there. And in the end, Porter's testimony was used against them.
And it's a continuing trend that we even saw in the Nero trial, where we have one of the co-defendants compelled to testify against a fellow officer, and it backfires. Officer Garrett Miller testified, I was the one that touched Freddie Gray, not Officer Nero.
That's right.
That backfired. And now you have Porter.
Officer Nero has also been acquitted of the charges.
Yes, last month. Right. Lesser charges than Officer Goodson, obviously.
Right.
But we have Officer Porter who testified, and it backfires again.
That's right.
And this is not and it's not just Officer Porter. You have several state witnesses over the course of two trials now where the witnesses became better defense witnesses than better state witnesses.
That's right. Absolutely.
So the next trial,
Lieutenant Brian Race, July 5th, maybe.
July 5th?
July 5th, maybe, because the one thing that I noticed over the last couple of trials as well is the state relying on general orders. And the judge said today that you cannot effectively convict somebody on general orders. And for those who've been in the area longer than I have, the first case that comes to my mind is Stephen Pagato. The Court of Appeals reversed that decision. He was convicted in 96 of manslaughter when his gun accidentally went off and shot a suspect under the arm, and that suspect wound up dying. Mm. And the state at that time used general orders. The Court of Appeals 4 years later said he might have broke the rules, but it doesn't rise to the level of a crime. And that was another thing that the judge in the Goodson trial said, that it might show bad judgment or it might show forgetfulness, but it doesn't rise to a level of criminal negligence.
In this case, when you're referring to general orders, you're talking about
the
relatively order. New order. It was new at the time of the
Well, it was
arrest.
Revised.
Okay. But that order that suspects should be seat belted in.
That's right.
There is so
and,
much
and,
to talk.
And keep in mind that in the Nero case, the judge pointed out they failed to show that Nero even read that order. They showed he received it, but they couldn't show that he read it. Here, they went to great pains to show that Officer Goodson was aware of this change, but then the judge says, again, per the Pagato case, that just because he violates, you know, this internal order, that doesn't mean that that's a criminal offense. Now, with regard to Lieutenant Rice, they may not be able to show that he was even aware, but even if that the seatbelt was required, but even if so, you're still, the judge, as Kenny has indicated, has told the state that that by itself is not good enough to convict him of a criminal offense.
And we're basing it looks like the trials, these are going to be the evidence going forward that the state's going to use. So whether they decide to move forward or not, that remains to be seen at this point.
A lot remains to be seen and so much to talk about. I really appreciate your both giving us these insights. Warren Brown, defense attorney, and Kenny Burns, WIPR reporter who's been covering the trial. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you.
WIPR's coverage will continue this afternoon during All Things Considered. And on Monday, midday, we'll pick up the question again, looking at the trials, the verdicts, what they mean for the police and for the community. But right now we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to switch gears. This weekend, Baltimore welcomes a film festival celebrating movies that were never meant to last. Stay with us for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're switching gears now. Are you old enough to remember this?
There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He'd duck and cover, duck and cover.
Duck and Cover. That was a clip from a 1951 animated film funded by the U.S. government advising children what to do in case of a nuclear explosion. It belongs in the category of film known as ephemeral cinema. Ephemeral as in floating away, not long-lasting. Other examples include industrial films, educational films, advertisements, and home movies. What all these genres have in common is that they were produced for specific purposes at specific times, and they survived only by accident. What can films like these teach us about our history and culture, about the ways we see ourselves? A lot, according to my guests this hour. Archivist and filmmaker Rick Prelinger is a world authority on ephemeral films. He's the founder of the Prelinger Archives, a collection of more than 60,000 such films. It's now in the Library of Congress. He's also associate professor of film and digital media at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila.
It's very nice to have you. And here with me in the studio is Dwight Swanson. He is a founding member of the Center for Home Movies, an organization that celebrates and preserves home movies as cultural heritage. He's also the organizer of a festival taking place in Baltimore this weekend titled Cinema Ephemera, the Festival of Useful Film. Dwight Swanson, welcome to Midday.
It's great to be here.
It's really nice to have you. Rick Prelinger, the duck and cover clip we heard is preserved in the Prelinger Archives. What can we learn from films like these?
So one of the wonderful things about ephemeral cinema is it doesn't just show how things looked. I mean, it's great at that. It shows the way people dressed, the way we lived, where we worked, our houses, and so on. But these films also preserve the persuasions of the past, how we were supposed to be, how we were supposed to behave. What would it mean to be a good citizen, a good boy or a good girl, a good consumer and a good student? And, you know, that's what's kind of hard to pull out of history. And these films are an incredible record of what we were supposed to be, how we were told to behave.
Now, that's interesting to me because, I mean, in a way, I think I could make the argument. I would not argue with you since you have put so much of your intellect into this. But I could say, well, it's actually the very planned films, the produced films that are, you know, where there's a script and there's people have thought through exactly who's going to say what, when those are the films that would really be showing us how we ought to be.
You know, are you talking about, for example, Hollywood films,
yeah.
Dramatic films? Where,
yeah,
so, you know, we've all been influenced by entertainment. We pull our positive and our negative role models out of it. But there's something about the fabric of everyday life that, you know, you don't really see it in a feature film where everything is constructed, where people worked very hard to make sure that nothing in within that glowing rectangle appears by chance. But ephemeral films are, you know, they're partially because they're sort of temporary. They're not made to last forever. They're a much more authentic snapshot of how things were. And, you know, especially home movies. Home movies are just on a kind of down and dirty grassroots level, really wonderful records of daily life.
Right. And home movies are Dwight Swanson's sweet spot, I understand. Dwight Swanson, before I turn to you, I want to play another clip. This is from a 1969 film that will be shown as part of the Cinema Ephemera Festival this weekend.
Whenever people gather in churches, there's a need for dignity and quiet that is conducive to worship. But occasionally, things happen. Something goes wrong. When this happens, it calls for prompt action from one trained to meet such situations. The church usher.
This is an animated film, a training film for church ushers. So we don't get the full effect on the radio. But tell me, Dwight Swanson, What do you find compelling about films like these?
So with this festival, I tried to bring in people who have developed these collections over decades and have been having their own screenings with the audiences. And as I've been an audience member of these, I'm just fascinated by the range. We try to include as many types and styles of filmmaking as possible in this weekend. And I just, for me personally, it's just looking at, again, what Rick has said, looking at things from my perspective in 2016 and bringing my own personal history to them, but trying to put myself in the mindset of you know, just looking at what life is in the case of home movies or these more personal films, or, you know, how society was expressing itself in so many different ways.
Has there been this kind of film festival before?
Not exactly. These collectors have gathered a couple of times, but only for much smaller screenings. And so when I was thinking about how to pull this off, initially I had been wanting to bring these collectors to Baltimore, you know, one at a time. And when I needed a project to do this summer, and I thought, well, why don't I just go all in and bring them all together, or as many of them as we could afford to bring into town. That would be, more interesting and more fun for the audiences, but also would allow them to have their own discussions, you know, after the films were done, and hopefully might lead to kind of more thoughtful, considerations about what these films are, what can be done with them, and so on.
So who is going to be here for this festival?
So at the core of it are archivists who also have their own personal collections, and they're ones who have been doing public screenings. So like we have, well, Rick from San Francisco, another collector from San Francisco, Raleigh, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and a couple from Houston. So we brought them all in, and they within their communities they do these public screenings, and so that was like the core group that I wanted to bring in, because they have a whole history, they have their own audiences, but I wanted to show their films to the Baltimore audiences. Then I started expanding that list too, and I got to know recently that there is a collector of these films actually just like a mile away from my house who I didn't even know until recently. Another archivist who is starting a home movie archive of African American films. She recently moved to Washington, is working for the Smithsonian, so she's bringing some films that she has been collecting. And then we also wanted to open it up to different ways of screening. So we're bringing in local musicians too, to kind of, you know, add their own expressions to the films.
Huh. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Dwight Swanson and Rick Prelinger about the appeal of ephemeral films like educational films, training videos, and home movies. You can be part of this conversation. Do you remember watching educational films when you were young? Did any of that stick with you? Have you visited the Prelinger Archive online or seen industrial or educational films? What did you find compelling about them? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Rick, did I hear you just about to make a point? I thought I heard your voice.
A quick point, building on Dwight, one of the cool things about this kind of film is that, you know, this is not an academic thing. It only recently got that way. It was archivists and collectors and fans that sort of put this material on the map, and now the scholars are kind of catching up, but it took about 20 or 30 years. A little bit like Star Trek, you know, where fans drove something that then turned into deep scholarship. So this is a real example of kind of, you know, citizen research and citizen scholarship leading to a phenomenon.
Well, I was going to ask you whether for some of these films there's a kitsch factor in the footage, that whether that's part of the appeal to some people.
You know, the kitsch factor is undeniably there. These films are pretty funny. Sometimes you laugh with a grimace at the same time. But, you know, this is why they're great. This is history that's accessible. It's history that's fun to watch. But, you know, I do want to say, I mean, it's funny to talk about movies on a day like this. And useful cinema isn't just fun and games. The historical record moves in all kinds of directions. You know, and you played Duck and Cover, which is about sort of the civil defense scam, as many of us see it now. And a lot of us are in the archives business because we think that saving history can help to make justice possible, that, you know, the records also have power that can help us to change the world. We see this with home movies and citizen journalism and people shooting video on the street. And so, you know, when we think about ephemeral films and useful cinema, sure, it can be funny and sure, it can be appear a little bit crazy now, but there's a reason, you know, why we're in this business. There's a reason why we're archivists, I think.
That's very interesting. That there's a point to it that some of us may miss in watching some of the disjointed films. Dwight Swanson, how much of the material we're talking about is available on the internet?
Of the films that are being shown this weekend, very, very few. And that was kind of by intention, too. But more and more of these are available specifically because of Rick's philosophy of, you know, putting his vast collection online. So more and more of it is available. But there was, you know, there's, if you consider how much of it was made, that's really just the tip of the iceberg. You know, there was such a huge number of filmmakers and a huge number of films that the cost and the time that it takes to digitize them and put them online, you know, it takes so much effort that it'll never be completely available. Although, you know, more and more it is.
Rick Prelinger, this weekend, when you're in Baltimore, you're going to show a film that you made entitled No More Road Trips. Tell us about that.
Yeah. You said No More Road Trips, right, because there's a question mark at the end. So what this is it's a dream ride across the United States from Atlantic to Pacific, made out of other people's home movies, about 80 or 90 families from the 20s through the 70s. And what it is trying to show is history, landscape is history made visible. I'm trying to see how the history of the 20th century is shown through changes in the landscape. What kind of road trips were they? There's the famous kind of, you know, Jack Kerouac road trip about discovering yourself, about coming to some kind of realization by traveling across country. There's the road trip by people who are trying to escape from a situation where they lacked power or where they lacked work to a place where there might be more resources for them. There are many kinds of travel, many kinds of tourism. And so what this film is it's an interactive film where you watch different parts of the country go by. A lot of the scenes are quite provocative and really, really interesting. And the thing is, the audience talks their way through. It's a silent film. So I invite the audience to ask questions, to identify places, people, and events that they might recognize, to engage in spirited disputes with their neighbors if they disagree, and to kind of think about what mobility has meant for all of our communities over time.
Let me make sure I'm really understanding this project. You basically raided parts of hundreds of home movies, road trip movies movies that families and others made of their trips.
Yeah.
You sort of put it together and organized it by the geography, not chronologically.
You got it. The narrative is all about geography. I tried to keep that strictly accurate. I made one or two mistakes, and maybe people in the audience will see that. But the continuity is all moving from east to west, from Atlantic City to Los Angeles.
And even though I guess some of these, how many was it? 800?
I looked at about 4,800 films, and I pulled out about 800, and I made a 14.5-hour version, and then cut it down to 80 minutes, and that's what I'm going to show.
And so I assume there probably was some soundtrack on some of that, but you didn't use that. So you've left...
All silent.
You've left it open for the audience to bring comments, reactions out loud.
So, you know, movie directors are usually control freaks, but I'm not a real movie director, and this isn't a real movie. It's more like a movie event, but the audience, every time it's shown, it plays differently because the audience makes that soundtrack, and the audience makes their own experience. I mean, I'll prompt people, and I'll tell people a little bit about what I know that we're seeing, but it's up to the audience to make the show really zing.
It's up to the audience to make it zing. Is that typical of the kind of people who want to come and watch ephemeral films, that the audience participates a great deal, Dwight?
Yes, definitely. Even if they don't really intend to or expect to, that's our job. Those of us who are in love with home movies is to get them to connect. Lots of times my organization does an annual project called Home Movie Day, where people bring in their home movies. And especially the first time people come in, there's a lot of skepticism about, you know, the idea of watching other people's home movies. And what we find is that very quickly that goes out the window as they just watch the films that are on the screen, and they start to connect with the films and especially connect with the people there. So
we need to take a quick break, and I want to talk more about home movies and ephemeral movies in general. We're going to continue our conversation about ephemeral cinema and what we can learn from it. You can join our conversation. You can send an email to midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about ephemeral cinema, also known as useful cinema. The genre includes advertisements, industrial films, and home movies. I'm speaking with Rick Prelinger, founder of the Prelinger Archives, and Dwight Swanson, organizer of an ephemeral film festival that will be in Baltimore this weekend. Dwight, let's talk to DC, who has called us from Brunswick with a question. DC, welcome to Midday.
Hello,
DC, you're on the air.
Hello.
DC, your question or your comment?
I have a friend who was in a training film for bus drivers when she was a little girl, and it was something to do with how to handle emergencies. And she's been trying to track down a copy of the film that she was in, but hasn't been able to. She doesn't know the title. She was probably about 10 years old when it happened. So I didn't know if you might have any ideas or resources on how to come about that.
I don't know either, but we'll try to find out. Rick or Dwight, any suggestions for how someone like DC can research an educational film about truck driving safety?
Boy, it's a tough one. You know, we think that over 500,000 films in this category were made, just like every company and organization makes websites now. Back in the old days, they used to make movies. So if you want to get in touch with one of us, we're both easy to find online. And if maybe we know the locality or the year or something like that, we could try to help.
I appreciate that offer. And DC, if you want to get in touch with us at midday@wypr.org, we'll see whether we can put you in touch. It does raise for me the question, Rick, of how one goes about organizing and making accessible so many these films. I mean, how do you categorize them, and how do you, aside from the fact that so many have probably just disappeared and aren't findable at all, how do you make things findable once you have possession of them?
Great question. A bit like herding cats, you know, and we're still, it's still a young field. The first thing is to try to gather information about films that we know we have and films that, and then films that we know were made. I did a book a few years ago with help from the National Film Preservation Foundation and the Mellon Foundation that was a snapshot of like 500 really important films, and I'm trying to expand this project right now so that it could be a guide for scholars and researchers and media makers and citizens who are interested. Gosh, it's like having a library filled with books that haven't been cataloged yet. We're just at the beginning of this.
There are tens of thousands of films in the Prelinger archives. Do you have a sense of how many more are out there that have not been preserved?
Home movies are infinite, so we can sort of put that aside. There's probably billions of them. Maybe Dwight has a more precise idea. But as far as like non-theatrical and useful cinema, America is such a media-rich country. We throw away more media than most countries ever produce. And in terms of films or videos that haven't found a safe resting place in an archives, I think there's six figures. You know, it's a lot to do, and we're going to lose a bunch of it, but we try to save what we can. Can I tell you about a really cool film that we found that's going to show
sure.
this weekend?
Sure.
As an example. So this was a film that came up on eBay, just in kind of some sale of junk that nobody wanted, and it was made by Baltimore Luggage Company in town. And it was shot in about 1957, Dwight, I believe. And they're making luggage in Baltimore, and it's an integrated factory of African-American and white workers. And everybody has dressed to the nines because they knew the movie crew is going to be there that day. And it's just a little 8mm epic, but you see women in poodle skirts and men in their Sunday best manning the production line, making suitcases. And it's a very life-affirming, positive film just made probably by the person who owned that factory. But it's a living record of what life was like for working people in one part of Baltimore in the 50s. And I think a chunk of that film's going to show as part of the Baltimore-rama program?
Right, Baltimore-rama.
Yeah, tell us about that, Dwight.
So that's a Sunday afternoon at the Motor House. And because we gave the presenters the general theme of place for their entire, you know, for the entire weekend. And since this is, you know, a Baltimore project, we wanted to specifically focus on Baltimore for part of the program. So there's going to be a presentation where we have found and digitized a whole selection of films from Baltimore, ranging from 1904 to 2000, all different styles, and trying to kind of look at the city, specifically look at the built city, but how people interact with you know, the city itself.
I think we have a clip that is part of that about Baltimore housing from the 1950s. Let's listen to that.
Gas-lighted streets, spotless front steps, colorful screen paintings. These, you say, are Baltimore. True, but Baltimore, like most American cities, is also block after block of incredibly bad housing. I'm a worker for the Baltimore Housing Bureau. I had a job that hot summer day, to find someone in the neighborhood with whom the Housing Bureau could work. There were great plans to rehabilitate this area, but plans have only a paper and pencil reality. Without a neighborhood leader, someone known and liked, our plans would get about as far as a painted bird on a window screen.
Wow, it's a very relevant clip. Is that part of the Baltimore presentation?
Yes. So my colleague, Siobhan Hagen, she is going to be editing dozens and dozens of these films that we have found, many of which we've digitized for the first time, and, you know, kind of created a panorama of the city.
Rick Prelinger, you said a minute ago, home movies are infinite. Let's put that aside while we're talking about something else. But I want to pull it back. I don't want to leave home movies put aside, because I want to ask
sure.
you, Dwight, something about the history of home movies. When did people start making what we think of as home movies?
1923 is generally counted as the birth of home movies because that's when Kodak started mass producing 16mm film and 16mm cameras. There were, you know, experiments before that, different gauges that didn't catch on as well. So their earliest films that you generally can find are in the 20s, but at that point it was still... because of the cost of the film and the equipment, tended to be upper-class families.
It's very expensive then.
Yeah, it was. So either families with who had the means to afford the equipment, or it was also, you know, guys generally who were really into, the tools and photography and just testing things out. So as you get into the 30s and then 40s, an 8mm film comes along, which is, you know, much less expensive and the cameras are less expensive and it's just more and more available. So it's kind of a steady growth from the early 20s and into the 50s and 60s and 70s. And then it starts to go down as video comes in.
Well, but I do want to try to understand that connection point. I mean, I get as people had access to making videos, they made and make fewer films. But is there, Rick Pellinger, in terms of some of the trends that you look at, is there a continuum in the kinds of lessons, the kinds of things we can learn from ephemeral films? Compared to, say, the videos we all shoot on our cell phones these days.
Yeah, totally. So, personal media, I think, goes back to papyrus and paintings on the cave wall and quilts and diaries. And, in the middle is home movies and home video. And, today it's cell phone videos. We shoot a little bit differently today, I think. We don't shoot necessarily to record for posterity. I think we shoot video as a means of kind of, it's almost like social performance, like I'll shoot a little bit of video and I'll show it to somebody I'm sitting next to in a diner. It's much more a part of everyday social interaction, the performance of friendship. We'll also put stuff online as a means of speaking out to the world, because now, an ordinary person can become a YouTube star. So it's a little bit different than the family movie screen set up in front of the fireplace. Home movies were pretty private for the most part. And now there's this kind of, as Andy Warhol might have put it, but probably didn't, there's this kind of lack of this fuzziness between what's private and what's public. And so video is part of that. It's a ritual, but it's kind of a little bit maybe less portentous. It's much more everyday. We shoot video the way we might wave our hands in the air, or write a note.
And you raise the question of privacy, which leads me to ask you, Dwight Swanson, when getting back to films, actual home movies, films taken, a generation or two generations ago that people didn't expect to be shared publicly. Is there any ethical concern or any problem with you now making a film festival out of them?
Sure, there are. There are legal issues, and then there are the ethical issues, and that's always something that collectors and archivists, and especially the ones who are doing public screenings, keep in mind. If it's not coming directly from a family, if you haven't been given the collection by a son or granddaughter, but it's just shown up on eBay or at an estate sale. I think everybody works very hard to consider, what the maker or what the family would want, and try to not show anything that would really compromise them without, since we don't have their permission and their knowledge. But on the other hand, that's some of the most interesting things, and so it's definitely a kind of a constant challenge, ethical challenge to ourselves about what to do publicly with these private documents.
Kindness and respect, kindness and respect go a long way, I think. We're not trying to make people look stupid, and I hope that we do a good job that way.
But one of the things that you said a few minutes ago is sticking with me, Rick, and that was the idea of you mentioned something about the posed movies, the scripted Hollywood-style movies, where everything in that rectangle, that shiny rectangle, is supposed to be perfect, which is not the case with these ephemeral films. And so there are things that get caught in the frame that weren't perhaps what the filmmaker, the person behind that camera, actually intended to catch, but they are most interesting to us now, decades later. Or do you find that people are not smart about picking? Are we so used to looking in the center of the frame that we aren't smart about picking up some of what we could learn from the edges of the frame?
Well, Sheila, you just handed me a great one, because one of the things that happens when you throw home movies onto a big screen in a movie theater, and this happens with No More Road Trips, which we'll see, is that the change of scale turns the audience into really keen observers. The audience becomes kind of ethnographers, anthropologists, cultural geographers. No hint of human interaction, no eye line, no touch, no expression goes unremarked. No dairy truck. People say, you know, hey, what kind of milk is that? What street are we on? The audience turns into these keen observers, and they see everything, and hopefully they'll actually yell it out. So that's what's nice about taking a home movie that normally you would see on a little screen in the house and blowing it up in the theater, because we all become keen observers.
Dwight Swanson, we're down to just like a half a minute. What should people know about the cinema ephemera?
It's going to be taking place from Friday night through Sunday night at venues starting out in Station North, ending up at the Creative Alliance on Sunday night, which is when we're doing Rick's screening. Search for us on Facebook.
Do that. We will link to it from the midday page at WYPR.
And just take a look. We posted a list of the films, the titles at least, that are being shown. And there's, I think people will be surprised at the things that they won't be able to see anywhere else.
I really am grateful to you, Dwight Swanson, for giving us this insight into it. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
And thanks to archivist and filmmaker Rick Prelinger for making time for us today. Rick Prelinger is the founder of the Prelinger Archives, a collection of more than 60,000 ephemeral films now in the Library of Congress. This weekend, he'll be in Baltimore to present his film, No More Road Trips. It's made completely from home movies shot by hundreds of people. Rick Prelinger, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Sheila. It's been a pleasure.
And I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads, specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. University of Baltimore lawyer Daniel Hatcher argues that the foster care system is designed to siphon federal aid for children into state coffers. We discuss what he calls the poverty industry. That's tomorrow. And again, the top news this hour is that police officer Cesar Goodson, who drove the van in which Freddie Gray was fatally injured last year, has been cleared of all charges. WIPR will have more coverage this afternoon during All Things Considered. And on Monday, midday, we'll look at the verdicts and what they mean for the police and the community. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a good afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.